Okay, so this talk is about metabolic innovation in microbial communities, but I'm sorry to tell you that we're not actually working with microbial communities. That is a direction that we would like to go. But the story I'm going to tell you today is really about what kinds of genetic and molecular mechanisms might influence the ability of microbes to do some type of metabolic innovation in the context of a community. All right, so this is my favorite view of a microbial community because it's really pretty. But what it shows and what everybody here knows is that microbial communities can be very complex. There can be many different types of organisms in them. And the question that I'm going to talk about is, what happens when a microbial community is subjected to some kind of new selective pressure such that a new enzyme is needed? So there are a number of ways that microbes could be exposed to a pressure that would require them to develop a new enzyme. So one might be the appearance of a new source of carbon, nitrogen, or phosphorus in the environment. So if they can come up with a new enzyme that will allow them to degrade that new interesting molecule, they may gain a fitness advantage over their competitors in the environment. Another possibility would be, loss of a previously available metabolite in the environment that the microbes were taking advantage of. And if that metabolite suddenly goes away, then microbes that can come up with a way to make it again may be able to gain a fitness advantage. And finally, another possibility is blockage of an essential metabolic pathway by an anti-metabolite that might be secreted by some other microbe or plant in the environment, or could be, in the case of human infections, could be an antibiotic. So the reason that I'm focusing on enzymes is that life on Earth is totally dependent on catalysis by enzymes. So this is a really nice summary of why that came out of Dick Wolfenton's lab. And these are the half-lives for the uncatalyzed reactions for all of these reactions that are involved in biological processes. Okay, so you can see that this one is particularly striking. OMP decarboxylation is required for pyrimidine synthesis. And it has a half-life of 78 million years without catalyst. Okay. And so some of the faster ones down here have half-lives of days or hours. CO2 hydration is only 5 seconds, but that may be one of the least interesting from the metabolic standpoint. So it is clear that having an enzyme to catalyze a newly needed chemical reaction is likely to be essential when there is some type of new selective pressure. Okay, so the question that I'm interested in is, in a microbial community, which microbes are going to have the capacity to evolve a new enzyme in the face of a new selective pressure? Okay, this is one of my favorite slides. It usually elicits a groan from the audience. All right, this is or nervous laughter. So this is what we think we know about metabolism. And this is both an overrepresentation and an underrepresentation of what we know. So it's an underrepresentation because there are certainly lots of enzymatic reactions out there that we don't know about. It's an overrepresentation because probably no one organism on Earth does all of this stuff. So most microbes have on the order of 1 to 2,000 enzymes. But that is actually a vast underestimate of the catalytic potential that lies in each of their genomes. So this gets me to the topic of enzyme promiscuity, which has been the theme of my lab since I started. So How many people have heard of enzyme promiscuity? That's pretty good. So some people, this is a new form of promiscuity that you may not have been familiar with before. Okay, so a promiscuous enzyme reaction, according to my definition, is a secondary reaction catalyzed by an enzyme that is physiologically irrelevant. The physiologically irrelevant part is actually really important, and I don't have to belabor that to this audience, because if it's physiologically irrelevant, it's not seen by natural selection. Okay? So these are just purely accidents of the fact that reactive sites for the active sites of enzymes are highly reactive environments. And so what that means is if some non-canonical substrate can wander into that environment, sometimes some chemistry can happen.
How do you know if something is physiologically irrelevant? That would seem something hard to know.
That's a very good question, and I get that question a lot. And I have to punt some a little bit, but there are situations where I can be sure that something's physiologically irrelevant. So, for example, the enzyme that I'm going to talk about today has a promiscuous activity that corresponds to another enzyme that's in the proteome. And if you knock out that enzyme, this enzyme can't substitute. So that means its activity is physiologically irrelevant. It's also very, very low. So that's the kind of situation where I can be pretty sure that that's a physiologically irrelevant activity.
But, you know, Olin, let's say, in his experiments, you might see that if you overexpress that enzyme by a ton, it can substitute for the one you lost.
So I would say if overexpression can be achieved by some natural genetic process, then it becomes physiologically relevant, but it wasn't before. Like if you're overexpressing it on a plasmid with a copy number of 300 and you see physiological relevance, then the other situation where I know that, where I can say that a reaction is physiologically irrelevant is if the enzyme never sees a substrate. So there are interesting examples of enzymes that can use substrates that are completely anthropogenic, have never been seen by life on Earth. Those I would also say are physiologically irrelevant. They certainly, so I'll get back to that point. Okay. So I wanted to show you an example of promiscuity in E. coli alkaline phosphatase, which is specialized for hydrolysis of phosphate esters. And it does this with a pretty high kcat over km of 3 times 10 to the 7th per molar per second. I will remind you what that, I guess I'll remind you of what that means right now. All right, so this is hopefully a review of Michaelis-Menten kinetics. So if you plot the velocity of an enzymatic reaction against the concentration of the substrate, what you see is an increase that eventually levels off, and it levels off because the enzyme is just saturated. So this is this kind of behavior is described by this equation, and there are sort of two limiting cases you can look at. Okay, one is when the substrate is present at a concentration much, much higher than the Km, then Km is irrelevant, the substrate concentration cancels, and you get a maximal velocity that is kcat times the enzyme concentration. So kcat is the turnover number. It's the number of molecules that the enzyme will turn over per second. At the other extreme down here, the substrate concentration is much, much less than the Km. And under those circumstances, the equation simplifies to the velocity is kcat over Km times the enzyme concentration times the substrate concentration. So kcat over Km is the second order rate constant for the reaction of the enzyme and the substrate at low substrate concentrations. Okay? So that's to remind you what kcat over Km means. Okay, so E. coli alkaline phosphatase is specialized to hydrolyze phosphate esters, but it will also hydrolyze sulfate esters and phosphodiesters. The values of kcat over Km are extremely low, in this case 10 to the minus 2 or 10 to the 2 per molar per second. Okay. So at this point you might be wondering why anybody would even care about extremely inefficient enzymes that catalyze reactions that are physiologically irrelevant. So why would you care? Okay, so the reason is shown in this last column. So this is proficiency. This is the ratio of kcat over km to the second order rate constant for an uncatalyzed reaction. Okay, so you can see that alkaline phosphatase will cleave a phosphate ester 17 orders of magnitude faster than an uncatalyzed reaction, which is pretty impressive. But okay, the record is actually 26 orders of magnitude for an enzymatic reaction. So this is only sort of so-so on that scale. Okay, but notice that even for these relatively inefficient promiscuous reactions, the reaction is accelerated by 9 and 11 orders of magnitude. And what that means is that if one of these inefficient promiscuous reactions becomes important for fitness, it can, the enzyme can serve as a starting point for the evolution of a new enzyme. Being able to start 9 orders of magnitude better than background is a pretty good start. Okay. So, Eric, I think that's the second part of the answer to your question. Once it becomes physiologically relevant, I no longer call it a promiscuous activity. So if a promiscuous activity becomes important for fitness and it's recruited to do that job, then I no longer call it promiscuous.
Right. No, I mean, so this is my hobby horse, so I care about can you eventually measure things.
Let me interrupt the interruption, please. Maybe we should limit the number of questions per person to 3. Which will require you choose careful.
Although I did kind of.
Can you don't ask your questions?
you can sell them.
Okay.
I'm going to burn them on something really basic. So wait, the numbers for proficiency, those are just numbers. And it doesn't depend on how many enzymes there are or something?
Right. That's just the ratio of two rate constants. So the rate constant for the enzymatic reaction over the rate constant for the non-enzymatic reaction.
Okay.
Yeah.
So then you have 2 more.
Okay.
Okay. I do want to point out that not all promiscuous activities are inefficient. So this is one that we've worked with in my lab. There's an enzyme called 3B, or homoserine kinase, involved in synthesis of threonine, and it catalyzes the phosphorylation of this hydroxyl group on homoserine to form 4-phosphohomoserine. Kcat over Km is pretty respectable, over 10 to the 5th molar per second. It will also catalyze the phosphorylation of 4-hydroxythreonine, which differs only in the presence of this hydroxyl group. Kcat over Km is a couple of orders of magnitude lower. But this is still in the range of normal metabolic enzymes. Okay. Now, I think that this is a promiscuous reaction because this substrate is at least not a known metabolite in E. coli, and it's actually quite toxic to E. coli. Okay. So I feel like I'm safe on safe ground calling it promiscuous. Okay. So now, getting back to this question of the impact of promiscuity, we don't know how many promiscuous reactions each enzyme in the proteome of a bacterium has, because, of course, we just can't go out and measure everything in the universe. But there are some high-throughput substrate profiling experiments that have been done recently that show in some enzymes there are 40 different substrates, up to 100 different substrates. So we really have no idea how large this space of promiscuous enzyme activities is, but I think we can be sure that it is huge. In the context of an individual bacterium, okay, say E. coli has 1,600 enzymes, if you make a relatively modest assumption that there might be 10 promiscuous activities per enzyme, then that means that E. coli might have at its disposal 16,000 catalytic activities, should the environment change and something new be needed. Okay, so back to this question of who can evolve a new enzyme. Now I'm going to discuss this in the context of promiscuity. All right, I would expect that different microbes would have different abilities to recruit a promiscuous enzyme to do a new job, partly because the complement of enzymes in each bacterium is going to vary. Okay, so each of them is going to be doing some subset of this glorious metabolic pathway chart. So what they have to bring to the table is different. And the second is, even if they have an enzyme that serves the same function, so an orthologous enzyme, I would predict that the promiscuous activities in the orthologous enzyme should vary. And that's because of what I told you. If they're physiologically irrelevant, natural selection doesn't see them. Unless they get too good and they sort of poke their noses up and start interfering with metabolic pathways, and then they would get knocked back down. Okay. But sort of below that threshold, they're just going to drift around as mutations change the protein. So typical metabolic enzymes have values of kcat over km between 10 to the 3rd and 10 to the 5th molar per second. Promiscuous activities vary over a much wider range. So I showed you one example of promiscuous activity in the on the order of 10 to the 3rd per molar per second. And though, as I said before, promiscuous activities that are that high probably are never actually seeing that substrate. They go down to be very, very low, to the point where sometimes it's really hard to measure them. But we try. So I would say that promiscuous activities in orthologs should vary. And if you have a situation where, let's say, this is a fairly arbitrarily drawn line, but in a particular situation, you need this much catalytic potency to be physiologically relevant. Some promiscuous activities in some microbes might already be over that limit. So they might be just ready to go as a starting point for evolution of a new enzyme.
Yep. You said that the kind of promiscuous activities just drifts around. Do you really think it's kind of random? Or isn't there also a trade-off between specificity and efficiency, so wouldn't there be selection against for efficiency and against promiscuous activity?
There generally is for the normal or canonical substrate of the enzyme, so that's what natural selection is going to see. So natural selection is going to lead to enzymes that are specific enough that other metabolites in the cell don't get into the active site and interfere to a degree that affects fitness.
But if they're also selecting for more catalytic activity, wouldn't that also be selecting for less promiscuity, or is that?
So typically, enzymes that are under strong selection to be very efficient, often that does make them more specific. But that doesn't mean that they don't have promiscuous activities as well. Because, you know, at the end of the day, it's all about the fitness of the microbe and not about the, you know, the glories of catalysis of the active site of a particular enzyme. So that's why, in my mind, that's why these promiscuous activities are there. They're just accidents that don't interfere with fitness enough for natural selection to care. Okay, so I would predict that promiscuous activities in orthologs should vary, and that some microbes would be maybe better positioned for some type of metabolic innovation than others. I would also predict that the evolutionary potential of promiscuous activities should vary among orthologs because, and this is just epistasis, right? Mutations that take place in a different genetic background are likely to have different effects. And that could also affect what microbes in a community would be able to do something new. So again, if this is the threshold for physiologic relevance, there could be cases where and I'm going to tell you one today, where it takes a mutation to pop a promiscuous activity up above this threshold for periodic relevance. Okay, well, a single mutation is not that hard to get. Okay, but there could be other cases where promiscuous activity either starts really, really low, or it takes multiple mutations to get above this threshold, where those could be basically microbes that would be left in the dust. Because by the time they accumulate all those multiple promiscuous reactions, they may have been outcompeted by the guys who either started above this threshold or were able to get there in a single step. Okay, so I'm going to talk about this specifically in the context of a model system that we've been studying for a while. We actually came upon this system when we were exploring a different question. So it wasn't that we actually just said, we need to study arginine biosynthesis in E. coli. Okay, so the initial discovery of this was a little bit of an accident, but it turned out to be a good system to look at some of these questions. Okay, so there is an enzyme in E. coli called ARGC. It's N-acetyl glutamyl phosphate reductase. So it catalyzes the transfer of a hydride to this acyl phosphate to form an aldehyde. And it is involved in biosynthesis of arginine. If the gene encoding ARGC is deleted, the cells cannot grow on glucose as a sole carbon source because they can't make arginine. Turns out that there is another enzyme in E. coli that has a promiscuous ability to catalyze this reaction. And that is ProA, which is glutamyl phosphate reductase. So the chemistry that's catalyzed by these two enzymes is actually exactly the same. They are not homologous, interestingly, but the chemistry is the same. They differ only in the presence or absence of an acetyl group on the inhibitor. So it's perhaps not all that surprising that ProA has an inefficient ability to do the ARGC reaction. But ProA, if you knock out RHC, ProA cannot take over that job. Okay, that's the example that I was using before of how I can be confident in saying that this is a promiscuous ability because it's physiologically irrelevant. So it cannot replace the missing enzyme. However, a point mutation in the gene encoding ProA that changes glutamate 383 to alanine now allows this enzyme to serve both functions. Okay? So now it can do this reaction in addition to its primary reaction. Okay, now it's pretty bad at it. All right, so these are the kinetic parameters for the reaction that ProA normally catalyzes and this promiscuous activity that's the normal activity of RHC. So what you can see is that kcat over km for the normal reaction is about 10 to the fifth higher than for the promiscuous reaction. So that is a good part of the reason why ProA can't substitute for RHC. The E383A mutant shows a completely different picture. So the activity for the normal substrate has been knocked down to 69 per molar per second. The activity for the promiscuous substrate has gone up quite a bit. And what we have, so now what we have is an inefficient generalist enzyme. You can do both. So there has been a trade-off, loss of the normal activity in order to elevate this promiscuous activity. And actually, you might think that that is not such a good idea. But you might think I would like to keep my normal activity high and just bring up the promiscuous activity. Okay, but the key to this is that both these substrates are competing for the same active site. So each one is a competitive inhibitor of the other. So if you have a really good activity, that substrate is going to be a very potent competitive inhibitor of the promiscuous reaction, which means you're not going to get much flux through it. Okay, by bringing these two things sort of into a closer range, what's actually happening is that there is a better chance for the promiscuous substrate to get into the active site and actually for the enzyme to catalyze both of these reactions. So this is a point that is, I think, generally not appreciated in the world of enzyme engineering, is that if you need both functions, it's actually better to knock down the original one. Questions?
So I guess along those lines, you can estimate that it's presumably all the effect of the mutation is in Km. That the turnover, the K-cat, the enzymatic turnover is not affected for either, but the Km is affected in presumably opposite ways or maybe only for one of them.
Well, so I can speculate about what the mutation is actually doing, and I will in like two slides. I wanted to point out that this is one of those cases where we have a promiscuous activity that is not sufficient to achieve this threshold, but a single mutation pops it up above that threshold. Okay, so unfortunately we don't have a crystal structure of E. coli ProA, but we do have a structure of ProA from Burkholderia thailandensis, and the equivalent of glutamate 383 is sitting right here. And also, unfortunately, there are no liganded structures of this enzyme, so we don't know exactly where the substrates are sitting. But we do know that this cysteine is in the active site. It's actually the active site nucleophile. And glutamate 383 is 12 angstroms away from that. So this is my cartoon version of what I think this mutation might be doing. So glutamate 383 might be in a nice position to interact with the positively charged amino group of the normal substrate. If that glutamate is turned into an alanine, what that does is it would obliterate that nice electrostatic interaction and make this substrate decrease the affinity for that substrate. And it would also make some extra room in the active site to put this acetyl in. So that is complete speculation, but I think it makes a nice story. Okay, so now, getting back to this question of who. So this is now a good model system for us to ask, if all the microbes in the community suddenly needed to have an enzyme that could do this reaction, who would be able to do it? So the first question is, do orthologous ProAs all have the same promiscuous activity? So this is Akhil Khanal wearing a funny hat. And Akhil collected a series of ProA orthologs from 9 different bacteria. What they are doesn't really matter. They're listed down here if you care. And this is a table of the pairwise sequence identities between each of these pairs of enzymes. So the most similar pair was 86% identical, so that's E. coli and Salmonella enterica. And the least similar pair was Salmonella enterica and Xanocystina acetoborans, so 39%. Okay, so this is looking at a bunch of orthologs spanning a pretty wide distance in terms of sequence space. So Akhil measured the rate of this promiscuous reaction in each of those ProA orthologs. And this plot shows kcat over km for each of those orthologs, for each of the 9 orthologs. And you can see that they vary by a factor of about 40. Turns out E. coli is the best and Xanocystina is the worst. Okay, so they all do have the same activity. The next question is, do they have the same evolvability? So with the E. coli enzyme, we had found that changing glutamate 383 to alanine would make that ProA able to catalyze the RC reaction, both in vitro and in vivo. Okay, so,
How many such mutations can you find in ProA? Is there one?
How many mutations
would allow the switch? I mean, do you have just one that you pick by chance during the selection, or have you tried, if you have replicates, would you always find the same one, or?
So I'll come back to that in part. We found the one in E. coli in a situation where we had knocked out argesine. We were looking for an enzyme that might replace it. Nothing would grow. We could overexpress every open breeding frame in E. coli. Nothing would grow. And so we finally mutagenized it. We got tough. And in a colony that would grow, we purified the enzyme that had the missing RC activity, sequenced it, and found that glutamate 383. Okay, so I'll come back to the sort of replicant question actually right now. Okay, so the way we addressed the question of do they have the same evolvability was to make a library of these pro-A genes from each one of those 9 bacteria. And we did this, this was a few years ago, so we did it by error-prone PCR, which will basically sprinkle mutations throughout the gene. Okay. There are much sexier ways of doing it now, but they weren't available then. Okay, so the idea is that you make a library, however you're going to do it, and then we put it back into a strain of E. coli that lacked RGC and lacked Pro-A, and then we plated the cells on, they were actually plated on glucose and proline. For the purposes of this talk, it would be much easier if I could just say we plated them on glucose, but it turns out that everything that grew on glucose and proline also grew on just glucose, so you can just ignore that for the moment. Okay, and then what we were able to do is pull colonies off the plate and sequence the insert and find out what were the variants in the library that would allow the enzyme to serve as a new RGC. And since they could grow on glucose alone, as both RGC and Pro-A. Okay. All right, so this is a subset of the data that we got. So for every microbe, every sequence that we pulled out had a single mutation in it. Okay, so Seminole enterica, glutamate 382 was always changed to glycine. Yersinia enterocolitica, glutamate 385 was always changed to glycine or alanine, etc. Okay. So what that says is that this is the key mutation, which I think makes sense going back to my cartoon of what I think it might do to the active site.
The different position is just because of the alignment or what?
Yeah, because some of these orthologs have a longer N-terminus than the others.
Did you get them for all 9 of the homologs you tried?
Yes. I couldn't fit them all on one slide.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah, they're down there somewhere. But in every case, it was one mutation was blazing out.
So I guess this residue is highly conserved, relatively?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is a multiple sequence alignment, and that's why I was saying the equivalent of glutamate 383, because it's not always 383 in the numbering system, but if you do a multiple sequence alignment, it is completely conserved, and in every case we looked at, it was changed to an alanine or a glycine. All right, so now what we did, since we had identified the key mutation, was we went back and we put just that mutation into each ortholog and purified the enzyme, and then looked at the fold increase in the promiscuous RGC activity. Okay, and what you can see is that there's a huge variation in the evolvability of this promiscuous activity. So Yersinia enterocolitica was the winner, almost a 900-fold increase from one mutation. Pseudomonas putida actually only had a 10% increase. Okay, so I think clearly the evolvability of ortholog should vary. And again, I don't think that's very surprising because of epistasis.
So just a quick question. So how much of the actual substrate was used in each of these scenarios? Was it like a comparable amount to the cytoplasmic level by some estimate?
So this is a little bit of a tricky part. These numbers were actually measured in the reverse direction for technical reasons. But if an enzyme is a good catalyst in the reverse direction, it's a good catalyst in the forward direction. So even though it was measured in the reverse direction, we can make these kinds of statements. We are now getting ready to set up a reaction in the forward direction. It's tricky because the substrate is extremely labile, lasts on the order of a minute or two, and it has to be delivered to the active site of ProA from the active site of the enzyme that makes it. So we're working on that. Okay. A couple other interesting things.
I missed the first part of the talk. Can you comment on like why you have more increase in some of these?
What we have more what?
Why you have more fold increase in some of these? Like, are they originally pretty bad, or are they?
No. Okay, that's the next. The next slide is, this is a plot of the promiscuous activity after this one key mutation, plotted against the promiscuous activity that was in the wild type enzyme. Okay, and there is absolutely no correlation. This is a question that I get a lot, especially from people in the biotech industry who would like me to tell them which promiscuous enzyme should they evolve to get to the thing that they need. And they don't like it when I say, I cannot tell you. But I cannot tell you.
So does that mean that the bad ones did get, there was a tendency for bad ones to improve by more? To erase the correlation?
No, because some of the bad ones didn't improve much at all. So they're just.
But if there were no correlation between the fold change and your initial KCAT over KM, then there would be a correlation between your final KCAT over KM and your initial KCAT over KM, right?
So what I showed on the previous slide was the
fold change.
Yeah, so this is just the plot of the actual values.
Exactly, so if the actual values show no correlation, doesn't that mean that there is some slight anti-correlation between the initial values and the fold change?
Okay, somehow I cannot parse that question at the moment, but okay. I'll think about it, okay? Okay, so if we extrapolate, well, wait a minute.
So I guess one thing that I wondered about is that, so you see some guys work with like these tiny fold changes. Mm-hmm. Is there any chance that promiscuous reactions are much more sensitive to things like ionic strength, so that the reaction that's been selected is very robust and when you change sodium to potassium, it doesn't make that much difference, whereas the promiscuous ones might be much more sensitive to all those sort of details, and so that measurements in vitro might be less well correlated with rates in vivo?
So I don't think anybody has ever actually looked at that, but there is something important about this that I'm going to tell you about in a minute. Okay? So there's a reason. Why? Yeah, because this is kind of surprising, right? Why did we select this if it's so lousy? Okay, so I'm going to tell you that pretty soon. But I just wanted to extrapolate this kind of thinking to the general case, and that is that differences in the level of improvement or the evolvability of the promiscuous activity may make it possible for some microbes to recruit a promiscuous activity to do something new, while others are still playing around underneath this threshold. Okay. All right, so this is going to end this question. So it turns out that for an enzyme that needs to retain its original function, the story is not all about the new function, okay? It's also about what happens to the old function, and this goes back to what I was telling you about, that it's actually a good thing to bring the levels of the two activities closer together so that both substrates can access the active site. So this is the data I just showed you for the fold increase in RHC activity, just flipped around, and this is the other part of the picture, the fold decrease in the ProA activity. So in vivo, fitness is going to be determined by the balance between the fluxes that this enzyme can direct toward proline and arginine synthesis. Okay, so the story is a little more complicated. So Pseudomonas putida, that had this really tiny 10% increase, had a big decrease in the original activity. And so what that says is that if you need to recruit a promiscuous enzyme, one way to do it is just to knock the hell out of the original activity, and that will give the new substrate a chance to get into the active site. Okay. So this is all about the competition. And extrapolating to the general case, the lesson is that what works may depend on more than just the improvement in the promiscuous activity. It will also depend or be influenced by what happens to the original activity and what the fluxes are that are needed through those two reactions.
It's not totally obvious to me that it has to be like that, because the improvement could come from the binding, or it could come from how long it takes after you bow. Mm-hmm. Process it. So is it obvious that it's always in the rate of the binding?
So if you work out the math, it does turn out to be the ratio of kcat over km values that matters for the competition between the substrates. The equations are really, really ugly, but it's kcat over km, which kind of makes sense because it's like, who gets to the active site first?
No. Which ones had, which ones of these were the replicates that always had additional, specific additional mutations?
These were all the mutants where we went back and just changed the equivalent of glutamate 383 to ALA.
In the experiment, some species.
Yeah. So we. We didn't see a consistent pattern of other mutations along with
but in some species, every replicate had the same additional mutation.
Yeah, that's this one.
Yeah, so that was your third question.
I know. So, I'm still asking it. It's my third. But can you just go back to the one from the slide?
It can make it longer.
So like if I look at PPT, right, exactly that one, right? Uh-huh. All of them also have the G421E.
No, we haven't looked at that one.
So this is why I'm asking. This is exactly the one that shows like this kind of very weak effect, but. It's always on that same changed background, never on the ancestral background. So I wonder if maybe, there's got to be something going on that G421E,
yeah,
right?
We should look. Yep, you're right. Sharp eyes. I'd completely forgotten that. All right, so now I want to ask the question, what's next? Okay, so a single point mutation elevates this promiscuous activity so that it can do both things, but now we have a really lousy enzyme catalyzing two reactions that are essential for growth. Okay, so we call this the weak link enzyme. And in fact, when this enzyme is serving both of these functions, the cells don't grow very well. So this is engineered into the genome. The growth rate is about eightfold less than wild-type E. coli. So what that means is that there is strong selective pressure for these cells to figure out a better way to make proline or arginine or preferably both. Okay, so what happens next? So I'm going to show you the general model that is best accepted for how new enzymes evolve from promiscuous activities of old enzymes. And it's called the innovation amplification divergence model. And it starts with a gene encoding an enzyme with an inefficient promiscuous activity that's physiologically irrelevant. The first step is that activity B becomes important due to some kind of change in the environment. Okay. If that activity is inefficient, then an increase in gene dose by duplication or amplification should improve fitness because you have more copies. And once you have lots of copies, then you have lots of opportunities to accumulate mutations and explore sequence space. And that will lead to divergence of copies, where some of the copies might start being a little better at function B, and some of the copies might sort of revert back to being better at function A. And as the function improves, then this amplified array will shrink back down because carrying around a lot of amplified DNA is a metabolic burden. Okay, so eventually the idea is that you will end up with two genes, one that encodes a specialist for function A, and one that encodes a specialist for function B. The situation I'm telling you about is a little bit of a tweak on this model, because we started in a case where an inefficient promiscuous activity was not relevant when the environment changed. Okay, so our environmental change was deletion of an essential gene, but if you consider that an environmental change. So the RHD activity became important, but that didn't help the cells at all until there was a mutation. Okay, and then now we're ready to do this. Okay, so this is a process that has happened innumerable times over the history of life on Earth. And it is the process that is responsible for the evolution of vast superfamilies of proteins that are all derived from a common ancestor, but they now do different things. So this is an example of a phylogenetic tree of the protein kinase-like superfamily. Started with some common ancestor long, long ago, and by this process of duplication and divergence, there are now families that have different substrate specificities and different functions. This is not a process that is limited to enzymes. Here's a very beautiful phylogenetic tree of G protein-coupled receptors, showing again the same process of duplication and divergence. This process can also be involved in evolution through transcription regulators and transporters. So, getting back to what next in our particular situation, Sean U. McLaughlin was a postdoc in my lab, later joined by Jamie Kirshner. And what they noticed was that if they put this strain that lacks RHC and has the allele for, we call it ProA star, that encodes the E383A ProA, they planted those on M9 glucose, they could see big colonies on the background of small colonies. So that was interesting, because obviously those cells have figured out some way to make arginine or proline better. So they started sequencing the operon that contains ProA in a bunch of these colonies. So the operon consists of ProB and ProA. ProB is the enzyme that makes the substrate for ProA. And so what they found was that in 11% of these large colonies, there was a mutation in the minus 35 region of the promoter. In 71%, there was a mutation in the minus 10 region of the promoter. And these mutations had a pretty striking effect on the level of transcription of the operon. Okay, so the M1 increased transcription by 20-fold. Well, okay, increased the level of the messenger RNA, to be precise. Okay, which, since it's in the promoter, I think we can probably assume is an increase in transcription. Okay, and M2 increased transcription by 10-fold. These mutations both change that promoter region to be more similar to the E. coli consensus. So in the minus 35, the E. coli consensus is TTGACA. This mutation changes a G to an A, makes it more similar to the consensus. Okay, and similarly, this mutation makes something's wrong with this figure. I think I pulled a draft of the figure out. All right. The minus 10 region in the real mutant looks more like the consensus. Okay. In 9% of those large colonies, we actually found a synonymous mutation near the 3' end of ProB. And this mutation makes a new promoter for ProA. So what you can see here is that the level of the ProA transcript went up 23-fold. The level of ProB was actually maybe even a little decreased. Okay, and all of these mutations had really significant effects on growth rate. So between 3.5-fold and 5.4-fold compared to this parental strain. Okay, it's all good. The important part is here. 9% of the colonies had an amplification of a genomic region. So this is a plot of read coverage around the genome of two different isolates. And what's showing here is a huge increase in the read coverage in this particular region of the genome. So when we pulled the colonies off the plates originally, they had between about 4 and 10 copies of Pro-A star. And so we popped those things into flasks and grew them for a longer time. And over time, they accumulated more and more copies. It eventually leveled off in the range of 40 to 50 copies. Okay. I just want you to be impressed by that number, because one of the things people often don't realize is that this is not a nice, neat amplification of just the gene encoding the weak linked enzyme. It's actually a big genomic region around the weak link enzyme. So here's the Pro-BA operon. Here's the extent of those amplified regions in three particular clones. Notice that this guy has 18 copies of a 22 kb region. That's an extra 396 kb. So not an expansion of the genome by 9%.
So is it a duplication of 18 copies of the same?
So this region here was the size of the original duplication, and then after that, it just amplifies like crazy.
So, is it flanked by IS elements?
One end of it is. So this end in E. coli is fine, has an insertion element. The other end doesn't. So what appears to be true is that the initial duplication is caused by some kind of illegitimate recombination, because you don't get nice boundaries between homologous regions. So it's a little bit of an accident. But once you have the initial duplication, now you've got 18 or 20 kb of completely identical sequence. And then you get amplification really rapidly. Okay. All right. But the main important point about this is that 9% of those large colonies had amplification. And that means that we're now here. And we have the potential to do this. And we are setting up some rather complicated experiments to follow the dynamics of the accumulation of mutations in the rest of this process.
So they had amplification and the mutation?
The original colonies had only one of those changes. A promoter mutation, minus 35, minus 10, the synonymous mutation, or an amplification. And that's because we were pulling them off of plates. If we evolve these, the guys with the amplification, so what we've done is we've gone back and we've said, okay, if they have a promoter mutation, then will they still amplify? And yes, if we grow them for like 150 generations, the guys that have the promoter mutation will also amplify. The copy number is lower because they don't need as many copies. Okay. So along comes Giancarlo. Giancarlo is an undergraduate. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, in this evolution experiment, do you select for maintenance of the old function of that enzyme as well?
Yes.
And have you also checked whether any differences arise if you don't select for the old function by providing proline?
So that's one of the experiments that we're setting up now, is that now that we've, so we're making a strain with a YFP reporter and with knockout genes involved in biofilm formation and all kinds of stuff. But what we're going to do is we're going to adapt that strain under pressure to evolve in glucose alone. So both functions are important. And then what if we give it proline and we let it just go toward arginine? So that's where we're headed with it.
So after you pass each of them and you see the extent of amplification go up, how close are they to the wild type growth rate?
I Okay, there's the wild type growth rate, and this is the amplified. Okay, so they still have ways to go. And we also know that if we follow these guys for about 6 months, the copy number will start to go down. So we should be able to, within a reasonable PhD thesis, get to this point. We haven't looked at the original ones where we saw the copy number go down. Didn't, they still have made biofilms and things that interfered with the process. So that's why we were going back and making like the perfect starter strain to do this. Okay, so Giancarlo. Giancarlo was an undergraduate who came into the lab, and I was thinking about a project for him. I was thinking about, you know, good training experience, and nothing too hard, and like nothing really a lot critical. So I asked him to do the same experiment in Salmonella, and I thought, you know, maybe that'll be interesting, but at least he'll learn some things. All right, so Giancarlo did the same experiment in Salmonella. We first engineered in that glutamate 382 to alanine change that we knew was important, and then Giancarlo started spreading cells on plates. And again, he found large colonies, and he sequenced the ProBA operon in 100 colonies, and he found only one thing. He only found the mutation in the minus 10 region of the promoter, which is a little puzzling because we actually put in the mutation in the minus 35 region that was important in E. coli, and the cells grew much faster. So the minus 35, I do not know why the mutation in the minus 35 region didn't show up, but it didn't. Okay, so after 100 colonies, Giancarlo was getting a little bored of sequencing and finding the same thing. So he adapted four lineages of this strain. So again, the ArgC is knocked out, carries the allele for ProA star. He adapted it for 250 generations on glucose, and the growth rate improved pretty impressively. And then he sequenced the ProBA operon again. And now I'm going to compare this to the results from E. coli. Okay, so in Salmonella, again, he found this mutation in the minus 10 region occurred first in every lineage. And then he found some other interesting mutations. One was an energetic mutation just upstream of ProA star. He found two synonymous mutations in near the 5' region of ProA star. And he found one non-synonymous mutation. Okay, so as I said, the promoter mutation always occurred first. And now I'm only showing results for the level of ProA star. It increased the level of ProA star by tenfold. Okay. One trajectory that he followed, he got this mutation, and then M4, and then M3. Those are the two synonymous mutations. And these synonymous mutations in the 5' region of ProA star, each individually increased the level of that messenger RNA, and together they doubled it. Okay. This is clearly not a promoter effect. And these mutations doubled the growth rate compared to, so the promoter mutation increased growth rate by ninefold, adding these two synonymous mutations doubled it again.
So did you have amplifications in this background?
All right. So I was really intrigued by these synonymous mutations that had these huge effects on transcript level and growth rate. Turns out that people have been thinking about this sort of thing since the 1980s, and I apparently wasn't paying attention. But the idea is that when a messenger RNA binds to the small subunit of the ribosome, it actually has to be unfolded in order to bind, and then for the large subunit to pop on and start translation. So I think what's going on here just has to do with the propensity for secondary structure in that region of the messenger RNA. So, yes, everybody knows GC base pairs are stronger than AT base pairs. And there is a hypothesis out there that seems pretty reasonable that the more G's and C's you have in this head region of the messenger RNA, the more likely it is to fold up into a secondary structure. And that will impede binding to the ribosome. Okay. So in fact, both of these mutations change a G or a C to an A or a T. Okay. So that's probably what's going on here. The other trajectory that he saw after the promoter mutation, he got this intergenic mutation and then this non-synonymous mutation. And before somebody asks, we don't know yet what that does. So this intergenic mutation also increased the level of the transcript. The non-synonymous mutation didn't much. And together they increased the level of the transcript. Okay. So that's probably the same kind of thing because this is a change from a C to an A. So we think that that's the explanation. And just showing you the effects on growth rate, again, the promoter mutation increases growth rate by ninefold. The heterogenic mutation close to doubles that, and then you add in the non-synonymous mutation and it gets up to about twofold. Okay. The important thing, which Paul almost spoiled my punchline, is that there was no amplification in Sanguinella. And if there's no amplification, that means you can't do this thing. So that means that Salmonella apparently cannot go through this process and diverge a new version of RHC starting from Pro A.
Why can't it, why no amplification? Is it so because there's plenty of opportunity?
So I'll come back here in just a second. Let me see what this question is.
Well, maybe you'll talk more about it, and that's fine. But this reminds me of something that Otis had last week about new genes and the role of gene transfer. Can you just have one Salmonella population evolves and specializes, and the other one evolves and specializes the other, and then they just...
Yeah, so, I mean, my conclusion from this is that within the proteome of Salmonella, there is no opportunity to do this. So it would have to wait until somebody donated a gene that would allow it to do this. Okay. By that time, somebody else in the population might be off to the races, right? And the guys that can't start with something in their own proteome might be just sort of left in the dust. Okay. So, but it would definitely, the solution to this problem would have to come from polyhorizontal gene transfer. I'm still going to come back to that question because it's on the next slide. Okay.
But this may not be the final solution. If you give it longer evolution, a duplication, it used a low-lying fruit, low-lying mutations. The duplication will be perhaps the next month.
Yeah, so we haven't seen it yet. And in E. coli, we get duplications right off the bat. So, yeah. But then that gets back to the question of, okay, in a community, if E. coli and Salmonella are in the same community, E. coli is going to be able to do this quickly and therefore have an advantage compared to Salmonella that's waiting around for something that either will never happen or will happen extremely rarely.
You haven't compared E. coli and Salmonella together, their efficiencies?
No. So that's what I was saying at the beginning, that we would love to go toward looking at this kind of thing in microbial communities, but we need a community where everything will grow together nicely and we can manipulate their genomes.
Okay. Maybe it's just useful to hear. So there's a recent paper by Kalinko et al. Where they look for the same kind of evolution, but they stick the gene that has to evolve in different chromosomal locations in coli. And they show you get very different roots depending on where you get that.
That's on the next question. Yes, that's where I'm going.
Okay, so
interesting, but how contingent is it on the presence of an AS element on the side or something like this? Because that could wreck sequence.
So in E. coli, there is an insertion element on one side, and we see that's where the amplification ends in every case. On the other side, it isn't. But that is one of the things that we're thinking about. So the key question is, why doesn't duplication or amplification happen in Seminole? Because generally, amplification happens just fine in Seminole. So what's wrong with this picture? All right, so this is a plot showing syntenic relationships between the Salmonella genome and the E. coli genome. So there's Pro-B and Pro-A in each case. There are some genes that are the same on this side. There are some genes that are different. This side is completely different. Okay, so I can think of two reasons why we're not seeing amplification in Salmonella. One could be that it just doesn't happen in this region of the genome, and we're in the process of moving it to other regions in the genome to see if we can get it to amplify. The second reason is that, remember that these are like big regions of the genome, and it could be that there is something in the vicinity of Pro-B, the Pro-BA operon in Salmonella, that causes toxicity when the gene copy number goes up. So there are a fair number of cases known where either an increase in the copy number of a particular gene or something that screws up the balance between the stoichiometry of two genes will actually cause toxicity. So those are the two possible explanations I have for why we don't see amplification. But as I said, it's not quite as easy as popping, but we are trying to pop the Pro-BA operon into different regions of the genome to see if we can get amplifying in Salmonella. And I suspect that the reason we don't see it has something to do with the genome context. But that's all I can say at the time. Okay, so just to wrap up all of the conclusions, if this is the threshold for physiological relevance, some microbes may have a promiscuous activity that is good to go right off the bat. In other cases, it may take a mutation. If the promiscuous activity is not good enough to go right off the bat, then some microbes, the ones that can access a big improvement in the promiscuous activity, may be able to meet the challenge, whereas some others may not. And organisms that can't duplicate or amplify the gene encoding the leukonic enzyme may be out of luck for evolving a new enzyme by this mechanism. The caveats for that are that, yes, eventually something could come in by horizontal gene transfer. That may or may not happen fast enough to rescue these guys. The other caveat is that this whole picture would be different if the original function didn't matter anymore. Okay, so if the original function doesn't matter, then the starting template gene can just go off in that new direction. And this is probably responsible for a lot of antibiotic resistance, because the antibiotic resistance genes evolved to serve some other function, but now they're being hit with the pathogens are being hit with something new. So one of the things that we're going to be doing is just taking Salmonella and doing this experiment, but giving them proline, so now it should be able to evolve toward a new large gene, just given a single copy in the genome. Okay, so it's only when you need to retain the original function that you need to do this amplification divergence. And I just said that. Okay, so coming back full circle, I think the conclusion is that only some bacteria in the community will have the ability to evolve a new enzyme when there is some new selective pressure. I think that's something that everybody would have said starting at 9:30 if I had asked you. But what I hope I've shown you is that there are some understandable biochemical and genetic mechanisms that will influence who gets to do something new and who is going to be collecting the dust. Okay. And so these are the people, I showed you their pictures during the talk, who did the work, and this was funded by NSF and NASA Astrobiology Institute.
Going back to like the initial and the correlation or the lack thereof between like the fold change versus the original activity, I guess wouldn't it be also prudent to compare to the original activity not of the side reaction but of its native reaction? Because you could imagine like sort of, I think what Eric was saying in the earlier part, like that would be a way to get at the difference between kcat and km, right?
Yeah, so we did that. I didn't show those. The native activities, I think, varied over like tenfold range or something like that. There was more variation than I expected in the native activities. But, you know, those are values measured in vitro. We don't know what the levels of expression are in each organism.
Did you find any E. coli the same synonymous substitutions, basically, for the rubber? Or was this is a mechanism that's not...
So we haven't found those, but we haven't gone back and put them in E. coli. What we have done in Salmonella is, you know, getting kind of interested in synonymous mutations in that region. We've gone through and made all possible synonymous mutations in the first 6 codons. And in most cases, this, you know, higher AT the higher prevalence of ATs seems to hold. That helps a couple of them, it doesn't. So it's obviously more complicated than what I've just shown you. But those are, so, you know, if you pick 100 colonies off a plate or you evolve 4 lineages, you're only seeing some things. So there are obviously other things that are beneficial, and these other synonymous mutations we've put into Salmonella are obviously things that are good, but they didn't happen in the course of our experiment.
So you think in the fact that you don't see the E. coli means that there are other ways that optimize the enzyme in a more efficient way, and that's why you don't see it? Or is it that the sequence is so different that adding more A's or whatever it is doesn't really work there?
So on plates, you know, we're just looking at large colonies, so we're not looking at competition between guys. And so the ability to find a large colony on a plate depends on when a mutation occurs in the growth of the colony and its effect on growth rate. So it's a little bit of a blunt tool. So there could be mutations that have smaller effects on growth rate that we just don't see on plates. If we grow them in liquid where they're competing with everybody else, the ones that have smaller improvements in fitness will just get out-competed. So, I think there are many more things that are beneficial than we can see, but there are limitations to both of those approaches, so we don't always see the ones that have smaller fitness effects.
So, about some questions from under 30 contingent.
You were talking again about your promoter region. You said it was changes to ANT, but couldn't you also prevent hairpins forming if it was all purines or all pyrimidines?
Well, in the promoter, it's about RNA polymerase sitting down on the DNA. Mm. So there's no ability to form a hairpin before you make the messenger RNA.
Okay, so
the synonymous ones that were like in the Salmonella ProA, that's after the messenger RNA is already made. There are ribosomes chugging along. But after they get to ProB, they will fall off, and then you have to bind again to translate ProA.
To what extent, so to measure these promiscuous activities, you have to basically try every reaction, or is there some way to predict in some general sense or get like a big picture for many? What I'm wondering is if it would be possible to look across many species and take some crude way of thinking, well, these are substrates are more similar and make predict some patterns to get an idea of how much certain things are happening.
Okay, so if you want to predict promiscuous activities, there are a couple of ways. One is the examples that I've shown you are examples of substrate ambiguity. So they're substrates that look kind of like the normal substrate, but they vary a little bit. Okay? So often enzymes will be able to handle substrates that more or less resemble their own substrates. The other way that you can use to predict, okay, actually there might be a third. The second way that you can use to predict is that I showed you these divergence into superfamilies. It is often true that members of one family in a superfamily have a promiscuous activity to do the reactions of another part of the superfamily. So if you know what kinds of reactions happen in the superfamily, a lot of times you can get some ideas about.
What is it? Can you remind me of the superfamily?
So it is a large group of enzymes that has evolved from a common progenitor by this process of duplication and divergence.
Oh, okay. Based on that, the genes. Not
yeah.
The
so basically, these things all have some active site architecture that they inherit from that progenitor. And that's often used in different ways in different parts of the superfamily. But so you can have a normal function over here be a promiscuous activity for something over here. The third possibility is to try to dock stuff, which sounds like it ought to work, but isn't actually all that useful, because to get catalysis, you have to really position things right. So I'm not aware of anybody who's actually predicted promiscuous activities by docking. So the way that the field is moving now is more like the pendulum in most of the field toward high throughput screening. So there are multiple kinds of high throughput ways to just test to see whether enzymes have promiscuous activities rather than trying to predict.
Okay.